morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January the 18th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. In Sudan, civil society organizers in the capital Khartoum called for strikes and civil disobedience after security forces used gunfire and tear gas to disperse demonstrations.
This has not deterred the protesters, and every few days they stage another protest to show determination and the will of the Sudanese people not to be ruled by a military dictatorship.
South African university students fight mandates that require they be vaccinated against COVID-19 before returning to the classroom.
If it means I have to screen every 2 hours, then so be it. But means must be made. They can't take away my right to an education because I don't want to vaccinate.
The Africa Cup of Nations currently underway in Cameroon enters its second week. We look at some of the highlights and low points so far. The stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. In Sudan, civil society and human rights groups are condemning the shooting death of protesters during Monday's demonstrations. The protesters say they will continue to demonstrate until the military hands over power to a civilian transitional administration. Local media reports that three people were killed by security operatives. The incident comes ahead of a planned visit by top U.S. diplomats David Satterfield, the U.S. envoy to the Horn of Africa, and Molly Fee, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, who local media say will seek to jumpstart the transitional process to civilian rule. Suleiman Baldo is an independent analyst on Sudan. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that he backs calls for targeted sanction against the military and for the International Criminal Court to prosecute those responsible for the killings of the protesters.
This confirms a pattern of brutal repression by the coup d'etat and its leaders against peaceful civilian protesters who are demanding a return to a civilian-led, democratic transition in Sudan. And since day one of the coup, 25th of October, the military had only use of diesel power in response to these demands. This has not deterred the protesters, and every few days they stage another protest to show determination and the will of the Sudanese people not to be ruled by a military dictatorship. So far, almost 70 of those deserters have been killed. And the method used to disperse these protests are really brutal, such as the use of anti-aircraft guns. These are battlefield guns that are used against the protesters.
What do you think the condemnation by these international organizations, as well as civil society groups in Sudan, do?
There have been threats, for example, from the Biden administration to use targeted sanctions against the leaders of the coup d'etat because they interrupted a genuine and legitimate transition to democracy. And I believe it is about time that there be, consequences for this, deadly use of force against civilians who are unarmed and who are just expressing their opinion. Now, this is one way, and I believe another measure that should be applied are the targeting for, smart sanctions, targeting of the economic interests of the coup leaders. We know that the coup was staged to protect this interest by, the senior officers of the army and the parallel army of the rapid support forces. And I believe that, by targeting some of those economic interests, the message will be clear that there will be consequences where it counts for them, which is their money and their, their economic wealth.
Some human rights defenders, I understand, are calling on the International Criminal Court to also look into this, because this is not the first time they argue that protesters have been gunned down. What is your take?
It has been for 3 months straight, almost, since 25th of October, that, as I said, live ammunition was used against unarmed civilians. This is a crime against humanity because there are other ways of dispersing protests that do not involve their killing and their maiming. And when we talk about 70 people killed, there are more than 2,500 now people seriously injured across Sudan for just protesting. Absolutely unacceptable. And therefore, there is, a justification for this to be investigated by an international commission of inquiry, about the use of excessive and lethal force against, unarmed civilians in the context of this struggle in Sudan for democracy.
That was Suleiman Baldo, an independent analyst on Sudan. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Clotty. The AFCON 2021 tournament has entered its second week in Cameroon. This week, two teams from the six groups will advance to the round of 16. Over the weekend, authorities launched a massive campaign to test and vaccinate fans after football officials complained that due to COVID-19 restrictions, only 2,000 fans turned out for matches at stadiums that sat between 20,000 to 60,000 people. Such high-profile tournaments are closely watched when it comes to officiating of matches. The actions of referees and other match officials are often scrutinized, especially if their actions are deemed to have influenced the outcome of the game. Sports reporter and commentator Jonah Byakutaga joins me from Kampala, Uganda, to talk about how the matches have gone so far. And I started off by asking him about the highly publicized incident involving referee Janice Sikazwe, who officiated the match between Mali and Tunisia.
The Zambian referee Janice Sikazwe ended the game in the 85th minute. Now, the game is supposed to end in the 90th minute. He took the teams off the pitch. The Tunisian officials protested. They then realized the mistake and came back on the pitch. He added 4 minutes and 39 seconds and still ended the match under 90 minutes, this time in the 89th minute with a few seconds. And then the Tunisian officials protested again. This time he led the teams off. The game was done. He was escorted off the pitch by security. And as the Mali officials were having a press conference after the game, it was interrupted by CAF officials and they were told they needed to return onto the pitch. This is about 35 minutes later and told they had to finish the game. The Tunisian team refused to come back onto the pitch because they were already in the ice baths and players had already taken their kits off. And Mali were declared winners. So basically that was the controversy in that game between Mali and Tunisia. Eventually Tunisia appealed, but CAF threw the appeal out and said Mali had won the game because Mali reported back onto the pitch while Tunisia refused to get back onto the pitch.
And is this referee, Janice Sikazwe, still officiating at the matches at the AFCON?
From what's been reported so far, he is still in Cameroon, which means his name is still in the hat for later games. And just something to note, Jackson, this guy is a good referee. He refereed the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations final that Cameroon won, beating Egypt 2-1. He was in charge of that game. He then officiated in the World Cup 2018, two games, including Belgium up against Panama. So he is a guy with a good reputation. He's refereed at the top.
CAF says that he had a heat stroke, and that's the standing with that.
That's the official explanation, that it was a heat stroke.
Okay.
And Jackson, before we move on from that referee issue, we just need to emphasize that this does not reflect what African football is about.
Okay. Now, this tournament is obviously different from the past AFCONs in that it's being played during a pandemic. How has this affected the players and the fans? Is the energy different this time around? Can you feel it?
To be fair, like any other tournament, we saw the Euros also struggle with COVID cases, players being isolated in the middle of the tournament. A few teams have been affected. Gabon, for me, has been the one that's been hit the most. Their own captain, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, earlier today was sent back to England, to Arsenal, from Cameroon. They've discovered a few heart irregularities. And they've done checks. He and another teammate, Mario Lemina, who was also playing in the Premier League with Southampton a few seasons back, they've both been sent back to their respective clubs to get thorough checkups because their countries say they cannot do the thorough checks they need to do while in Cameroon. So they're trying to monitor, and it's all down to COVID. Both players had COVID earlier last week, and they've just recovered, and then they've discovered these discrepancies in their heart rhythms and what have you. So already that's a direct impact. Senegal themselves who are the favorites of this tournament, have failed to field their best team. The goalkeeper, Bernard Mendy, who plays at Chelsea, is yet to play in this tournament. Their captain, Kalidou Koulibaly, who plays for Napoli in the Italian Serie A, is yet to play. Naples Mendy, who plays for Leicester City. Idrissa Gane Gueye also missed the previous game. He plays for PSG with Messi. So Senegal, as much as they're favorites, they've not hit the heights that everybody expects. And a big part of that is down to the COVID that's hit their camp.
What are some of the highlights so far, some of the standout moments that will always define this tournament, whether it's the upsets or the brilliant plays on the pitch?
I'll go with the positives first. I'll go with the highlight for me has been Cameroon, the host, stomping Ethiopia 4-1. They fell behind yet again for the second game running, and they bounced back and scored 4. It's been the biggest victory, second biggest victory, because Tunisia did thump Mauritania last night 4-0, the previous night 4-0. But Cameroon thumping Ethiopia 4-1 at home. That old man, Vincent Aboubakar, their captain, scoring twice. He's now the top scorer of the tournament with 5 goals. So for me, that's the highlight, because they're the host team. You want them in the tournament for as long as you can to keep the interest in the tournament. And if I go to the what you call the lowlights or the upsets for me, but also outstanding, I've got to say Sierra Leone's win over the defending champions Algeria. That's a big, big shock, reminding so many people of the World Cup 2002 when Senegal upset France when they were the defending champions. This time, Sierra Leone getting that 1-0 victory of Algeria. Algeria's won a run of 35 unbeaten games. They were just 2 games short of equaling Italy's record of 37 games unbeaten. And that run has ended. Algeria, again, on the receiving end of another disappointing result. They drew in their first game with Equatorial Guinea 0-0. And now for Algeria, they've got to beat Tunisia in their final game to qualify. But you've got to mention the Gambia as well. They're debutants alongside Comoros. And we spoke about the debutants with you last week. And Gambia themselves, the debutants, they're top of Group F with 4 points. And they could eliminate the giant Tunisia. If they beat Tunisia in 24 hours' time, if they beat Tunisia, Tunisia will likely, and most likely would be heading home. So that's another big one, the Gambia being debutants in their first tournament.
That was sports reporter and commentator Jonah Byakutaga speaking to me from Kampala. South African university students are fighting mandates that require they be vaccinated against COVID-19 before returning to the classroom on February the 14th. Even students who have the vaccine and want others to get it are against the policy, and the students' union is threatening protests across the country. Linda Giftas reports from Johannesburg.
Universities across South Africa are gearing up for a new school year as the country emerges from its fourth wave of the coronavirus pandemic. And vaccines to prevent COVID-19 will be a prerequisite for many returning to campus. The South African Union of Students has warned protests of vaccine mandates are looming. At the University of Johannesburg, students say they're angry that they weren't consulted and claim the policies infringe on their constitutional right to bodily integrity. Walisi Manana is the president of the Student Representative Council for the University of Johannesburg.
Students must go to vaccinate under their free will. There's no one who is in a bio bubble. So whether you are vaccinated or not, the moment you leave campus to do your grocery shopping or go anywhere else, you come across people who are vaccinated and who are not vaccinated.
Less than half of South African adults have been inoculated, and there's no national vaccine mandate in place. The reasons behind vaccine hesitancy are complex. Students say their decisions are made on personal preference, cultural, and religious beliefs, despite there being no evidence such methods protect against COVID-19. Lingiwe Mlulu is an honor student at the University of Johannesburg.
From the first wave, I've stuck to African home remedies. I haven't been hospitalized, I've never tested positive. And I think because that worked for me thus far, I will continue with that remedy. People who have vaccinated are said to have been protected from the virus, and they should find ease in that. They shouldn't be bothered by the fact that someone else is choosing to not vaccinate and exercise that right.
Vaccines do protect people, especially against severe disease. But one of the country's top doctors says unvaccinated people pose other risks beyond catching or spreading COVID-19. Dr. Shabir Madi is a professor of vaccinology at the University of the Witwatersrand.
They are much more likely to end up in hospital, in ICU, and to die of COVID-19. And ending up in hospital is not just a burden that individual assumes. It's a burden that is shared across society, both in terms of the funding of the healthcare system, as well as other impacts that materialize in that hospital when there's needing to start to cut back on, as an example, elective surgery, because healthcare facilities are coming under pressure.
Which is why he's calling for tougher measures on those resisting the shots.
All choices come with consequences, and that's the whole point, is that a mandatory vaccination doesn't mean that we're going to tie you down or put you in prison if you choose not to be vaccinated. It should come with consequences, just like there are consequences to every other choice that one makes in life.
For unvaccinated students, it's losing access to campus. The University of Johannesburg said in a statement that exemptions will be considered on health or religious grounds. Exempt students will have to provide a negative COVID test each week. If they aren't granted an exemption, students like Lulu fear what being barred from campus will mean about their future.
If I'm refusing to vaccinate because it goes against my will and whatever it is that I believe, and the institution wants to protect me, then we must find means to find common ground. If it means I have to go for testing every week, if it means I have to screen every 2 hours, then so be it. But means must be made. They can't take away my right to an education because I don't want to vaccinate.
The University of Johannesburg says students can always regain campus access once they get their shot. Classes begin February 14th. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Rwanda, the Court of Appeal adjourned the hearing on the appeal of Paul Rusesabagina's prison sentence after he failed to appear in court. The prosecution has contested the 25-year sentence and is seeking a heavier penalty. Eugene Uwimana reports from Kigali that the court adjourned the trial to examine whether Mr. Rusesabagina had received his court summons.
The 67-year-old convict of terror-related charges, Paul Rusesabagina, has not been appearing in the courtrooms since March last year. He said that he didn't expect a fair trial and Rwandan courts are not competent to try him as he is Belgian. In Monday's hearing in the Court of Appeal, his absence was hot debate as well. The prosecution says he was electronically summoned, but he refused to sign on the papers and didn't go for a covenanting test, which is a must for all defendants to attend hearings. Prosecutor Jean-Pierre Habarema explains how they informed Rusesabagina. Rusesabagina was informed that he has a trial. The court sent a letter electronically on 17th December 2021. According to the letter we got from the prison, all other convicts have signed the letter, acknowledging that they were informed of this hearing except him. We strongly believe that he was legally informed, and laws stipulate that the trial should continue without him. Some defense lawyers who are not even representing Rusesabagina also said he was not summoned the right way. This is attorney Harriet Murekatete. She's defending Mark Nizeimana and Kasie Bizimana, Rusesabagina's fellow convicts. According to the law, it must be the court's secretariat or bailiffs that inform people about the court's summons. However, the report presented by the prosecutors shows that it is the prison that informed the defendants about the trial. This trial compounds 21 convicts who share the same charge of participating in terror activities carried out in southern Rwanda and killed 9 people. 14 of them are appealing, saying that they have collaborated with the court. Their sentences should be reduced. On the other hand, the prosecution says sentences were too lenient. Due to Rusesabagina's absence, Justice François-Régis Rukunda-Kuvuga adjourned the hearing and will rule first on whether he was rightly summoned or he is going to be summoned again. After hearing everyone here, the trial is adjourned and will be notified when to resume after examining this challenge of the absence of one of the convicts. On 20th September last year, that's when a verdict of a long-awaited trial were announced. Only Paul Rusesabagina was sentenced to 25 years in prison. The High Court Chamber for International and Cross-Border Crimes found him guilty of being a member of a terrorist group and committing acts of terrorism. Political experts say he is likely not appearing in appeals as well. If this happens, the trial may continue without him. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Kenya's electoral body commenced the second phase of voter registration this week, targeting members of its diaspora. The Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, or IEBC, provided a list of 12 countries that are eligible for diaspora voter registration ahead of the 2022 general elections in Kenya. Maureen Ojambo has more from Milwaukee.
The commission's chairman, Wafula Chebukati, said that the commission received additional funding from the Treasury to facilitate the second and final phase of registration, which he said targets to register 4.5 million new voters who were left out in the first phase, as well as diaspora voters who will only be voting for the presidential candidate.
The right of Kenyans to register as citizens residing outside Kenya or conduct elections outside Kenya shall be based on the presence of a Kenyan embassy, high commission or consulate. But it's important to note that a registered voter in diaspora will only be voting for a presidential elective position. But if they elect to change to Kenya, then they can vote for all the six positions.
In 2017, Kenya only allowed Kenyans living within East African region to vote. However, this year, the electoral body added more countries to the list. One of the considerations for the selection of voter registration countries was the number of Kenyan citizens in that particular country. The IEBC Commissioner Abdi Guliye said that the selected countries will have Kenyan citizens registered within the stipulated time frame.
Diaspora voting we allowed in the last election in the East African community in total, and we added South Africa. In 2022, we expanded to 7 new more countries. These include the US, Canada, UK, Germany, Qatar, UAE, and South Sudan to complete the East African community. So those are the countries that we have identified, and there's a particular criteria that was used to arrive at them.
A Kenyan, Dominic Mekenye, living in Minneapolis in the United States of America, says the commission's only having voter registration taking place at the embassy and consulates will lock out many diaspora voters.
I wish I could vote for the coming election. To me, myself, I won't be going because the consulate in Washington is really slow, even issuing the passports. We as Kenyans, like, I wish we could have had another consulate in Minnesota, because where I live to Washington, that would be like maybe 2 or 3 days, because I have to plan myself ahead.
Commissioner Guliye, however, says the Kenyan law only allows citizens living abroad to register as voters at the Kenyan embassies, high commissions and consulates.
We will be dispatching people to go and register Kenyans in those identified countries. We can only mount a registration center and a polling center at the Kenyan embassies, high commissions and consulates.
The diaspora voter registration exercise will start on 21st of January 2022 and end on 4th of February 2022. The voters will only be allowed to vote for a presidential candidate in the next general election. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. Thank you for spending this morning with us. For more African news and features, remember to visit our website at voanews.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Just search for VOA Africa. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sikus, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports, or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.